All right, buckle up for a deep dive into a Supreme Court case that still matters a lot today.
Oh, absolutely.
We're talking Simmons v. United States.
Mm-hmm.
A 1968 decision that shaped how we handle eyewitness identification.
Yeah.
And even self-incrimination. Can you believe that, Rick?
Big stuff.
So picture this. It's 1964. A Chicago savings and loan gets robbed.
Okay.
Three suspects. Simmons, Garrett, and Andrews. And get this. Five eyewitnesses.
Wow, so right away, a lot to unpack.
Oh, and don't forget the white Thunderbird in a suitcase just bursting with evidence. Intrigued.
Definitely. Sounds like something straight out of a movie.
Right. This case, it went all the way to the Supreme Court. Because this evidence, it seems straightforward, but it raised some really big questions about constitutional rights. What do you think?
Well, you know, it really shows how these seemingly simple cases, they can expose these super complex legal issues, especially when you're dealing with, like, eyewitness accounts and constitutional protections all mixed up together.
So let's start with those eyewitness IDs. Now, back then, instead of the lineups we see all the time now, the FBI, they used what was called snapshot identification.
Interesting.
Basically, they showed pictures of the suspects to all those witnesses.
Mm.
And all five, they identified Simmons from these photos just the day after the robbery.
Wow, that's quick.
I know, right? And later, three of them even identified Garrett. Seems pretty airtight, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, on the surface, it does sound pretty convincing. But this is where things get really interesting.
Okay, I'm listening.
So the Supreme Court, they did uphold these photo IDs.
They did.
Yeah, but they also set this brand new standard.
Oh.
They said that these types of IDs are only okay if the whole process, it wasn't so impermissibly suggestive as to create a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification.
Whoa, say that three times fast.
Right. It's a mouthful. Basically, they created this, like, balancing test, weighing the potential for suggestiveness against other factors.
So they weren't saying that using photos for ID was always bad.
Exactly.
This had to be done fairly.
Exactly. They had to consider the context, you know? Like,
yeah.
In this specific case, the court looked at things like, did the witnesses have clear memories?
Uh-huh.
Was the FBI pressuring them?
Right.
And really importantly, how long did each witness actually see the robbers during the crime?
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
And in this case, it seemed like their in-court identifications weren't just because they'd seen the photos.
I see.
They had other reasons to be sure.
They had, like, independent, solid reasons.
Exactly.
But I bet the defense team didn't just back down, did they?
Oh, not at all. They got creative. They tried to use this thing called the Jenks Act.
The Jenks Act? What's that?
Well, it basically says that prosecutors have to share any material that's connected to what a witness might say.
Interesting.
So the defense, they were like, hey, those photos, those are connected. Hand them over.
Smart move.
It was a clever tactic, but the court wasn't convinced.
Really? Why not?
They said since the photos were taken after the witnesses gave their first statements, they weren't really part of those statements.
Ah, technicality.
Yeah, technicality. But, you know, these legal specifics, they can really change the whole game.
Absolutely. They can make or break a case. So the photos were used for the IDs, but because of this legal loophole, they didn't have to be shared.
Exactly.
But I feel like this is where things get even more complicated with Garrett's situation.
Oh, yeah.
This is where those constitutional rights really clash.
Right, with that suitcase full of evidence. Right.
Yeah. So Garrett, he actually testified at a pretrial hearing, said that the suitcase, it was his.
Hmm. Why would he do that?
Well, he was trying to use the Fourth Amendment.
Okay. The right against unreasonable search and seizure.
Exactly. Basically saying, hey, you can't just search my things without a warrant.
I see.
But, and here's the catch, that testimony, it was later used against him at the actual trial.
Oh, so he's trying to protect himself from an illegal search, but then it ends up making him look guilty.
Exactly. That's the dilemma. And didn't that violate his Fifth Amendment right, you know, the right against self-incrimination?
Yes, absolutely. He was caught in this impossible situation, right?
Yeah.
Forced to pick between one constitutional right and another.
The classic catch-22.
And the Supreme Court majority, they recognized this. They called it intolerable.
That makes sense. You can't force someone into that kind of choice.
Exactly. They shouldn't have to choose between their rights.
So the court sided with Garrett.
They did.
Said that testimony from that pretrial hearing, it couldn't be used against him at the main trial.
Right.
But you know what's interesting? The justices, they weren't all on the same page about this.
Yeah, you know, those dissenting opinions, they're important too. Justices, black and white, they disagreed with that majority opinion.
What did they say?
Well, They thought Garrett made a choice, a conscious choice, when he decided to testify. Like, he knew he was giving up that Fifth Amendment right when he spoke up at the hearing.
Oh, yeah, I see. So they're focused on the idea of, like, a waiver, yeah. Right?
Exactly. And they were also worried about, you know, the bigger picture. Like, what if this new rule meant that guilty people could just, like, get away with their crimes just by, you know, cleverly using their rights?
Right, right. So even on the highest court, there's this debate about how far these protections should go,
yeah.
Especially if they might, like, get in the way of justice being served.
It's tough, right? You want to protect individual rights, but you also want to make sure that system works.
It's that constant tension, yeah.
Yeah.
Individual rights versus a legal system that can actually function.
In this case, decided back in 68, it still matters today. It was part of this whole wave of decisions in the 60s, expanding the rights of people accused of crimes. Think about Miranda, you know, the right to remain silent. Simmons built on all of that, making it clear that those constitutional rights, they actually affect how law enforcement has to operate.
So it wasn't just this theoretical legal concept. It actually changed how police could interact with suspects.
Right. It had real-world impact.
And it reminds us that the law, it's constantly changing. It's influenced by society, by these debates about fairness and justice, always evolving.
Exactly. You can see how Simmons was a product of its time. The civil rights movement, this growing awareness that individuals need to be protected, especially from potential discrimination.
So the court wasn't just looking at the details of Garrett's case or Simmons' case. They were sending a message.
Yeah, that safeguarding individual rights is paramount, even if it means excluding evidence that could be incriminating.
Wow, that's a big statement. So the court was really committed to ensuring a just system for everyone.
Absolutely.
But what about the lasting impact? How does Simmons still shape legal arguments today?
Well, Simmons created this roadmap, you know, for cases that involve eyewitness identification, that totality of the circumstances test. That's the standard now.
When courts are figuring out if an eyewitness ID is reliable, if it's admissible.
Exactly.
It's not just about whether a photo was used.
It's bigger than that.
It's about looking at everything surrounding that identification to figure out if it was fair, if it was accurate. I mean, think about how many times you've seen, like, a crime show on TV.
Yeah.
And the eyewitness, they point to the suspect in court. And everyone just assumes, well, case closed.
Yeah, yeah. That's why cases like Simmons are so important.
Right.
They remind us that eyewitness testimony, it's powerful, but it can be swayed by all sorts of things. The lighting, how far away they were, how long the encounter was. Even little cues from investigators can have an effect.
It's crazy how much can influence memory, right?
Yeah, and Simmons forces us to look at all those details. It forces us to acknowledge that memory isn't perfect, that people can get misidentified, and it happens.
It adds this layer of complexity to something we often just take for granted. That eyewitness account, it's always reliable.
Exactly.
But beyond the whole eyewitness ID issue, Simmons also gave us the Simmons rule.
Right, that's important too.
Like a shield, right?
Yeah, for defendants during those pretrial hearings.
So what does it actually do?
It basically says that prosecutors can't use the defendant's testimony from those hearings against them at trial if they object.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, it goes back to that idea of not making defendants choose between their Fourth Amendment rights and incriminating themselves.
Making sure they can actually exercise their rights without being penalized for it later.
Exactly.
So even though the specifics of Simmons might seem kind of outdated now,
yeah,
you know, snapshot IDs instead of modern lineups.
Yeah, different times.
The core principles, they're still alive and well in our courts today.
Absolutely.
It's a reminder that these legal precedents, they have a ripple effect.
They do.
Shaping how we balance individual rights with effective law enforcement.
That balance is so important.
And it's a constant conversation.
We're always evolving.
Well, we've really gone deep into the legal nuts and bolts of Simmons. But I want to bring it back to you, our listener. What sticks with you about this case? What questions does it raise for you about eyewitness testimony or self-incrimination? Or maybe that tension between individual rights and law enforcement? So we've been really digging into the specifics of, you know, Simmons v. United States. But I think it's time to zoom out a little. Look at the bigger picture. What does this 1968 case tell us about our legal system, both back then and even now?
You know, what's so interesting about Simmons is that it captures this really pivotal moment in American legal history. It really shows that trend in the 60s, where the Supreme Court issued all those decisions that really expanded the rights of people accused of crime.
Right. Simmons is like a prime example of that shift.
Exactly. It's like building on those landmark cases that came before it. Think Miranda v. Arizona, right? that whole right to remain silent.
Right, right. You have the right to remain silent.
Simmons basically took that idea and ran with it, made it crystal clear that the Constitution, it's not just some abstract set of ideals.
Right.
It has real practical consequences for how law enforcement interacts with people.
It's about real people, real situations.
Exactly. The court was sending this message loud and clear. Safeguarding individual rights, it matters. Especially when there's a chance for abuse.
Wow. It's almost like they were kind of predicting the future a little, right? Knowing that these protections would be needed.
And in a way, yeah, they were looking ahead. And it's this powerful reminder that the law, it's not static. It's not stuck in time.
It's always changing.
Exactly. It evolves. It responds to what's happening in society.
Right.
And all those debates about fairness and justice, those never really stop. They keep pushing the law forward.
They're the engine, right, mm-hmm. driving the law to adapt and change.
Absolutely. And you can see how Simmons, it came out of this specific context. The civil rights movement, this growing awareness that individuals need protection, especially from potentially discriminatory law enforcement.
So the court, they weren't just laser focused on the specifics of Simmons' case or even Garrett's case.
No, they were thinking bigger.
They were making a statement.
Yeah, that protecting those constitutional rights, that's the priority, even if it means some evidence gets excluded, even if it points to guilt.
It's about protecting everyone's rights. Not just getting a conviction.
Exactly. Ensuring a fair system for everyone.
It's a powerful idea. But before we wrap up, I have to ask, does the Simmons ruling actually strike that balance? Protecting the rights of the accused while also making sure that guilty people don't just walk free? It's a tough question, right?
It is. It's the million-dollar question. And it's something that legal scholars, lawyers, judges, they're still wrestling with today.
Yeah, I can see that. It's not an easy answer.
No, it's not. But Simmons, it reminds us that there's always this tension between individual rights and effective law enforcement. How do we make sure investigations are thorough? How do we make sure justice is served? But at the same time, how do we uphold everyone's basic rights? Even the people accused of crime.
Right. Everyone deserves those protections. Innocent until proven guilty and all that.
Exactly. And that's what makes this case so fascinating. And the discussions it sparks, they're still so important. Simmons v. United States, it wasn't just a ruling, it was a catalyst.
It sparked a change.
Yeah, it pushed us to constantly evaluate our system, refine it, strive for that perfect balance between individual rights and public safety.
It makes us think critically about how we decide guilt or innocence and realize that every decision, it has these ripple effects.
Exactly. And that's what we hope you'll take away from this deep dive. Simmons, it's a reminder that the law, it's alive, it's breathing, it changes as we face new challenges, as we rethink old assumptions.
Oh, keep those lessons from Simmons in mind. As you engage with the legal world, question, analyze, and always aim for a system that upholds both justice and individual rights.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us as we explored all the twists and turns of Simmons v. United States. This case, decided over 50 years ago, it still has so much to teach us about that delicate balance at the heart of our legal system.